Well, I grew up as an astrophysicist, and actually at the age of, I must have been 20 years old, I think. I had a couple of summer positions at the Royal Greenwich Observatory in England, and I was intending to grow up, graduate, and become an astronomer. But something happened in the third year of my undergraduate degree. I had a very talented professor teaching my solid-state physics course, and we went through all of the usual stuff about how you make a semiconductor, you know, the details of how Intel actually makes its transistors out of silicon and how you understand the physics of that. And I remember at the time, this is so long ago now, that the average transistor on a circuit was a little over a micron in size. Now I think they're at 45 nanometers, which shows you how far that's gone. And that's, of course, is the progression of Moore's Law. And Gordon Moore predicted in the 60s that the size of transistors would continue to decrease. The number of transistors on a chip basically doubles about every 18 months. And although the demise of Moore's Law has been predicted for a long time, it's kept going. And so we covered Moore's Law in this class. And as the last lecture of the year, this professor gave a sort of fun lecture about where electronics might go in the long term. And as I remember, the long term back then was 2001. You've got to remember, I'm talking about 1984 here for when we did this. And if you keep shrinking the size of transistors on a processor, eventually you get down to the size of a molecule, and particularly an organic dye molecule. So this last fun lecture was, what would happen if we could actually invent molecules that behaved like transistors and diodes, and then do electronics at the fundamental building block scale of matter? And that was back then what we called molecular electronics, which was really nanotechnology before the word became cool. And in the space of a month, I decided that this was such an inspirational idea that I wasn't going to be an astrophysicist anymore. And I changed around a few of my final year courses, graduated in solid-state physics, did a PhD with the very professor that gave that lecture, and really never looked back.
Well, how would you define nanotechnology or nanoscience?
Well, I have some odd definitions. I mean, nanotechnology has become so much what I call a suitcase term that includes so many different versions of technology that it's almost become meaningless. But I like to say that nanotechnology is not a length scale, it's a state of mind. Nano, of course, the prefix nano comes from 10 to the minus 9. It's actually the root form is from the Greek word for a dwarf. So nano is a billionth of a meter, and that's where nanotechnology gets its name. It's because we start to process materials on a scale of a billionth of a meter. And that's about where the electrons in the material start feeling the walls. If you can make a material that small, the electrons essentially get squeezed, and so you can change the energy level of the electrons in a material if you can process it at the nanoscale. So you can make tunable materials. Both their optical properties and their chemical properties of a material can be tuned. But if you try to define nano in terms of that length scale, you run into an issue of what I would call scope creep. Because the actual things you're trying to make are often bigger than that, so a lot of things get lumped in with nanotechnology that years ago would have been called colloidal chemistry and everyone would have been happy with it. So what do I mean when I say nanotechnology isn't a length scale, it's a state of mind? What it really enables you to do is start by designing the fundamental building blocks of matter, which are molecules, and that's really where my research has gone. I worked on molecules that when you put an electronic charge on them, they emit light. Well, you can use such materials to make very, very thin flat panel displays. The technology is called organic light-emitting diodes, and usually goes by the acronym OLEDs. But what you're doing there is now the functionality in a material gets designed in the chemistry lab, not in the physics lab. You design the molecular structure of the material so that it emits green light or red light, and these are all different molecules, or blue light. And you make a display, and then you build up to make that display. You build the molecules up into a device. And that's what I call the first major technological revolution since the Stone Age.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you're here from Washington in Edmonton at the Nanotechnology Conference, and you just finished giving your lunchtime talk. And one of the things you did was take the audience through the history of manufacturing from the Stone Age to the molecular age. But where are we now?
Well, to get from the Stone Age to where we are now, if you remember, only took one slide. Because what we did in the Stone Age was we discovered that we could take lumps of rock and shape them into useful tools. Arrowheads, axe heads, and nothing fundamentally has changed in the way we think about materials. When Intel or AMD or Texas Instruments make their most complex chips now, they start from a lump of silicon. It's a lump of rock. Now, the details have changed. The rock is a lot cleaner. You spend a lot of time, energy, and cost making the silicon very, very pure. Tools have changed. We don't bang away at the rocks and chip bits off them anymore. We use very advanced technologies called photolithography to etch away the material so that only the tiny transistors are left behind. And the products have changed from axe heads and arrowheads to microprocessors and very advanced technology. But the concept of using materials is still, we take a lump of material and chip away at it to make a useful device. Where the first revolution occurs is now when we stop chipping away at it. We stop banging the rocks together, finally. And what we are now is what I sometimes characterize as the micro-stone age, because we're doing everything smaller, cleaner, and more expensively. But the first revolution is when we take that step of designing the functionality that we want into the molecule and then making it build up. So it's sometimes called the revolution from top-down to bottom-up manufacturing. And that, for me, is at the heart of nanotechnology. And that goes back to what I mean when I say nanotechnology isn't just a length scale, it's a state of mind. It's a way of thinking about making materials that frees up a vast wealth of potential structure and function that you can design into a material. And the beauty of it is, by the way, that nanoparticles, as I said, have been around since the Stone Age. Nanoparticles are all around us, which is why I have trouble with the people that say we should regulate nanoparticles or regulate nanotechnology, because it's very hard to regulate something that's just in the environment with us. But what we've never been able to do is control it. So in fact, nanotechnology gives us the ability to control now and intentionally synthesize nanoparticles with specific functions. So it actually, in terms of technological risk, I believe it decreases the risk of technology.
Well, you bring up the subject of risk, and certainly with any new emerging technology, there's always some concerns. Well, what is it that we actually are getting ourselves into? And when you look at where we're going with life sciences and some of the bad publicity over things like genetically modified foods, what's it going to take to keep nanotechnology from falling off the rails the same way that genetically modified foods did?
The biggest issue is that scientists are notoriously bad at communicating their science to the general public. Scientists talk amongst themselves, they talk to funding agencies, but they don't go out, I'd almost characterize with tongue in cheek, they don't go out into bars and tell people about what they're doing. And so the public gets a very distorted view of science from the media, I believe. The fault is with the scientists. Like I said, my PhD supervisor back in 1985 told me that if I couldn't explain what I was doing to the bartender, it wasn't worth doing. And I've always kept that with me. As you said, any new technology has risk associated with it. There's always risk of unforeseen consequences. There's risk that a material will have some level of toxicity. And nanomaterials, when you nanostructure a material, as I've already said, it changes the chemical functionality of the material. Well, it changes that functionality in good ways that you design, but it also changes the functionality in the way that it'll interact with biological matter, and so it will change the toxicology. So there's risk there, but it's no bigger risk than with any other new chemical that's introduced into the environment. So nanoparticles, nanomaterials, will have to be tested for toxicity in exactly the same way as so many other chemicals should be tested, but by the way, far too few of them actually are. So that aspect of the risk isn't really unique to nanotechnology. It's really general way that we deal with new chemicals being introduced into the environment.
So what do you say to the good people of Berkeley who have tried to regulate nanomaterials?
Well, Berkeley has introduced regulation that regulates, I believe the quote is, a material with a length scale less than 100 nanometers in any dimension. And as I've already said, it's very hard to regulate nanotechnology as a length scale. 100 nanometers in any dimension basically includes the entire semiconductor industry right now, thin films, optical coatings. So it's regulation that's so broad as to be essentially meaningless. And a good analogy is... Now, I apologize, I forget the name of the legislation, but might be Proposition 65, but excuse me if I got the wrong number. Some years ago, California introduced legislation, which you still see on packets, of that this product contains chemicals known to the state of California to cause cancer. The fact is, you see it on almost every packet of anything that you buy, and when was the last time you really paid attention to it? It's the same with this legislation on nanotechnology. It's so broad that it essentially becomes meaningless. It's really unnecessary, I think, to create new regulation for nanotechnology. It's unnecessary, and it will produce unintended consequences, and it has a chilling effect on technological innovation in the field. There's legislation that already exists, specifically the Toxic Substances Control Act, sometimes known as TSCA, that regulates new chemicals and significant new uses of existing chemicals. If we use that and apply it to nanotechnology in a rational way, I can't see that it won't be very functional.
Would you say you're on a mission in terms of communication about nanotechnology?
I don't know whether I would qualify myself as being on a mission, but it's certainly something I think it's important for scientists to do, because, again, the public gets its information from people like you, right? And if scientists aren't transmitting the information on what the risks are, then the public's going to get a distorted view. And in the end, it's the public that funds science, and they have a right to expect scientists to explain what they're doing on a level that they can understand, because it's public taxes that funds most of science. So if I'm criticizing anybody, it would be the scientists that don't spend enough time going out and communicating the nature and the risks of their technology to the public. And so I don't know about a mission, but I've given nanotechnology lectures at all levels, from middle school up to university. And if you explain it at the right level, I find people get it. And if you explain the fact that, yes, nanotechnology is a new technology, nanomaterials that we're creating are new, and there will be some risk associated with them. But here's the thing. What we're doing now in terms of a society has enormous risk associated with it. The way we treat chemicals, the way we burn fossil fuels, is absolutely unsustainable. We all know that. So, in fact, there's phenomenal risk with just sitting still and doing what we continue doing, putting more and more greenhouse gas into the atmosphere, for example. Who knows whether there's really a correlation right now? Well, there's certainly a correlation, but who knows if there's causation between the CO2 that we put in the atmosphere and the climate change that we're observing. I don't even want to argue about it, because it's very easy to see that if we keep putting more and more into the atmosphere as we're doing, something bad is going to happen at some point. So if we just keep using the technology that we have right now, there's very, very significant risk that we're going to damage the planet. Now, nanotechnology offers new ways to use energy. It offers new solar cells, new ways to perhaps convert carbon dioxide back into hydrocarbons using solar energy. We could, as I sometimes put it, close the carbon cycle, make burnable fuels from the CO2 in the atmosphere. Nano offers the possibility of doing that with new designed catalytic membranes with this designed chemical functionality in them. And there's always going to be risk with those new materials, and we have to quantify it, we have to test the materials, and we have to make sure they're safe. But we should never forget that there is very significant risk in not doing it, because where we are right now might be sustainable for your lifetime, but I seriously worry about the quality of life of your kids if we keep mining these non-renewable, polluting energy sources like we're doing now. So yes, nano has risk, but don't forget that, as an old Special Forces friend of mine used to say, they tell you in training that anything you do on a battlefield can get you killed, including nothing. It's the same with technology. Anything that we do with technology right now could damage the planet, including nothing. We can't stand pat and ignore nanotechnology. We should develop it in a responsible manner, and it has enormous potential to mitigate many of the problems that we're causing.
Thank you very much, Paul.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.